Hello and welcome to No Confidence. My name is David Merlin. Nothing you'll hear me say is intended as legal advice. Anything that sounds like that to you, just consider something somebody else might do in a planet far, far away where the law matters. It doesn't matter if you're proven on a daily basis, believe it. It's May 27th, 2019, a Monday. You want to have a pen handy to write down web addresses, details, maybe a case site here or there. And tonight's topic is about, and this is part of my Monday and Tuesday evenings in May series. I'm recording this, so I'll be posting it in the chat or in the archive. I go to the homepage of takefromcaesar.us. Takefromcaesar.us. I'm going to put that in the chat. And then you might be on your own because I got to watch this site that I'm pulling up. Takefromcaesar.us. And then I scroll under the picture of the $25,000 check that I got when I set up the city of Kirkland for a violation of the State Disclosure Act. Under that check, there's a segment of the homepage called links. In those links, you have the first ones on the left and then the second ones on the left. The third one in the second column says, "Don't say threat." That's the topic for tonight. I went to takefromcaesar.us. I scrolled down below the picture of the check for $25,000. And I click on the link that says, "Don't say threat." I've done some study on this topic because the word threat is thrown around so recklessly that it's the threat is the person alleging the threat. They're so stupid. And there's things you have to know in case you hear somebody else say that you've uttered a threat. You need to be able to nail this because a lot of people are coming unglued. If you watch you listen to the news, go on YouTube, you can see that the left is coming unglued. And they've issued plenty of threats. They have remained unprosecuted. So this page is oriented under Washington state law that says you can make a citizen's arrest. So you know that saying citizen's arrest is not a threat. It's lawful. And then you have federal laws about what is and is not, or what is punishable as a threat. And we've got a bunch of case law that says what you have to do to qualify to be guilty under threat statutes on the Ninth Circuit. That's West Coast. So I cover Washington by reviewing Ninth Circuit decisions and Supreme Court decisions. You want to do follow-up work on your circuit. I start at the top of the threat page. Again, this is takefromcaesar.us. I scroll down under the picture of the check in the links. There's a link that says "Don't say threat." And I pull up that page. Don't say threat until you know this about how that term is misused and about the associated risks. True threat, define. True threat is in quotes because that's how they define what a prosecutable offense is under threat statutes. It has to qualify as a true threat. This exercise seeks to clarify what conduct constitutes a violation of federal criminal statutes that prohibit threats of unlawful violence. You've likely noticed how the term threat is recklessly applied to obviously innocent conduct by the media and by others. But here you'll see that there is a very specific and plain threshold and formula for determining probable cause that an unlawful threat has been made. This exercise is focused on the Ninth Circuit. It cannot be read to govern altogether how threat statutes are enforced across the country or on other circuits. For the purposes of other circuits, an analogous compilation of authorities from one's own circuit must be assembled and carefully reviewed. The law punishes what it calls a true threat, which must be a threat to commit an act of unlawful violence conveyed in first-person context. I'm going to stab you with a knife is an example of such a threat. I'm going to incite somebody to stab you with a knife is not a threat. It has to be a first-person context. I will do this to you. I will do this to them. Unlawful violence has to be conveyed. And from U.S. versus Bagdasarian, but as we have explained, incitement of others, incitement to kill or injure a presidential candidate does not qualify as an offense under 879A3. That's a threat against a candidate for the presidency. It carries 5 years. and that's a Ninth Circuit case from 2011. The judgment in that case was on July 19th of 2011. They reversed his conviction under that threat statute, saying there's no first-person threat in his blog about then-candidate Obama. And then another quote from Bagdasarian. I'm just going to read the bold and italics. No other circuit has concluded that incitement can be punished under a threat statute. And over 40 years ago, in a case since cited approvingly in most every presidential threat case in our circuit, we expressed doubt that Section 871 makes criminal an intention or tendency to encourage others to injure the president. We've explained that if Congress desired to prevent incitement of others to assault the president, then it would have limited the statute to make it a crime to incite or induce others to assault or attempt to assault the president. In refusing to find that incitement qualifies an offense under 879, so forth. So it has to be a first-person threat to commit an act of unlawful violence. Here we have a quote from U.S. versus Lanier. Oh, first, this paragraph. Precedent must be observed and serves as a constraint and as guidance. Quote, but unless we wish anarchy to prevail within the federal judicial system, a precedent of this court, the Supreme Court, must be followed by the lower federal courts, no matter how misguided the judges of those courts may think it to be. See Hutto versus Davis, 1982, Supreme Court. All of this goes out the window in tax cases, by the way. You can cite as many as you want that say exactly this. We got to go by precedent. And then when you prove you've beaten the IRS, the judge comes in. They won't mention any of the authorities you cited, and they give the judgment to the government. And you don't get an interpretation of statutes that you relied upon. Period. That's what we've just done for 4 years. In court after court after court. Two lawsuits in South Dakota, two in South Carolina. Counterclaim in Kentucky. Tax court in Texas. Appeals on the 7th, 9th, and 11th circuits out of tax court, and three petitions to the Supreme Court for those three. The law is off limits. Read the homepage of takefromcaesar.us. In quotes, here, indented, we have referred to the Court of Appeals when inquiring whether a right was clearly established, or a law, clearly established law, you can rely on appellate decisions. It doesn't have to be a Supreme Court decision. Unless there is a Supreme Court decision in existence. See U.S. versus David Lanier. And notice there's a case references are linked. That takes you to scholar.google.com so you can read that case. U.S. versus David Lanier, I like citing that. This guy was a threat. a Tennessee chancery judge who would invite women from the divorce cases he was hearing in his courtroom to visit him in chambers to talk about possibly getting a job or discussing custody of the children. And he took to raping them in office, and the DOJ had to go all the way to the Supreme Court to get an indictment against him to stick. He fled to Mexico. They went down there and they got him. Really seedy dude. Anyway, the next paragraph begins with key in bold. For the purposes of federal criminal threat statutes, a true threat is a threat to commit an act of unlawful violence against an individual or group of individuals which must be conveyed or uttered in first-person context. There's the case law on it. The act of unlawful violence communicated or threatened must be an act to be carried out, quote, by the defendant, end quote. And here's the case that says so, Ninth Circuit, 2005. So what I'm trying to do is show you there's clear thresholds and boundaries for the meaning of the term true threat under the law. Below is another threat statute, but one which is general in its scope, not restricted to former or current government employees or officers. The criteria for what constitutes a true threat is the same under this provision, 18 U.S.C. 875C. So if it wasn't a public official you were threatening, they'd probably use this on you. They might use this on you even if you weren't threatening them. It's just America. C. Whoever transmits in interstate or foreign commerce That's post office, the mail, the internet, telephone. Any communication containing any threat to kidnap any person or any threat to injure the person of another shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 5 years or both. The Ninth Circuit says in 2007 about that statute, a conviction under 875C requires the specific intent to threaten, and only true threats may be prohibited. And it cites U.S. versus Twine, which is another case that's linked from this page. You'll find it cited here somewhere. So, having outlined that unlawful conduct must be uttered in first-person context for the law to prohibit it. Well, it's obvious that a citizen's arrest of a felon is legal. Here's the Washington state law that says so. Okay, so that's not a true threat, is it? Because it's lawful violence. It's authorized by law. If you clicked on citizen's arrest, it'll take you to my citizen's arrest page on wevgov.com, where I have all the quotes from the NexusLexis database on citizen's arrest, circa 2012. So I've looked at this topic for a long time. We have this Washington State Statute, Revised Code of Washington, RCW 9A16020, use of force when lawful. The use, attempt, or offer to use force upon or toward the person of another is not unlawful in the following cases. Number one, whenever necessarily used by a public officer, like a policeman. Number two, when necessarily used by a person arresting one who has committed a felony and delivering him or her to a public officer competent to receive him or her into custody. So, citizen's arrest is legal. I'm going to check the chat to see how many people we got. It's still just you and me, Boing Snap. Thanks for hanging out with me. And we see now, in bold type under that statute, Section 1 of the Washington statute above is the source of law enforcement's authority to make an arrest, according to U.S. District Court in Seattle and the Ninth Circuit. How about that? I think John versus Barry is Ninth Circuit. No, that's District Court, Tacoma. So we have these District Court decisions where they say, yep, that's where law enforcement gets its authority. Well, if subsection 1 is valid for policemen to make an arrest, subsection 2 has to be legal for people making the arrest of a felon. Nothing says you should treat them differently. They're both legal or they're both illegal. So it's not unlawful violence. I just slammed the door on that. And so you send an email to the felon who stole your car. So your car is stolen. You know who stole it, and you want to go arrest the person. And you can under the law. It's a felony to steal a car. Okay. But I send them an email. Maybe I'll get my car back. And here's the email. And think at all times, are you guilty of a threat to commit an act of unlawful violence against another person when you say this in your email? On Friday, September 3rd of 2019, this is the part in red, I, blank, Joe Citizen, will apply to a panel of Americans that I've assembled to view the evidence to offer evidence of felonious conduct on your part, which constitutes an ongoing threat to public safety, hoping to cause the issuance of a writ of probable cause from the panel to substantiate the arrest of your person under 9A16020. To substantiate, not to authorize the arrest. The law authorizes the arrest. Substantiate it, I just mean I'm going to create reasonable suspicion that a felony has been committed in the minds of the people on the panel. Or you are. Anybody. I've been pushing this idea for a long time. Public safety panel. Second paragraph. Upon the issuance of said writ, 50 or more concerned citizens with knowledge of your crimes will enter your home and arrest you to take you to competent authorities as provided by law. Do not resist, as these citizens will be heavily armed and will meet all resistance with all necessary force as provided by law. If you have evidence to the contrary, you are hereby notified that the hearing upon my application for said writ will take place at a certain address If you default or otherwise do not appear, and if my application is granted, I would advise you to keep your front and back doors to your home unlocked to better facilitate your lawful arrest. End quote. Is there any unlawful violence? Is there any first-person context? No. And that's the end of your email. And so, right below that, is the email legal? Do not resist indicates a desire and intent that nobody incur an injury of any type. By law indicates a belief that it is legal to arrest the felon. So there's no criminal intent either. You have to have criminal intent to be guilty too, as you'll see. Second line, identify indications that the essential elements of the true threat statute, 875C, are borne out by the language of the email above. Is there criminal intent when a statute that authorizes the arrest of a felon is actually cited directly in the email? Is the lawful arrest threatened by the email an act of unlawful violence? Is these citizens a first-person reference? No. It's as clean as it can be. And here's a quote from, as you see, United States versus Alonis, 2015. It's about Section 875C. And we see in the first paragraph, second sentence, the presumption in favor of a scienter requirement, that means knowledge you're committing a crime, should apply to each of the statutory elements that criminalize otherwise innocent conduct. The parties agree that the defendant under 875C must know that he is transmitting a communication. But communicating something is not what makes the conduct wrongful. Here, the crucial element separating legal innocence from wrongful conduct is the threatening nature of the communication. The mental state requirement must therefore apply to the fact that the communication contains a threat. Does the guy know he's making a threat? It's a requisite element they have to consider, and the DOJ has been ignoring it for years. The Alonis case cites a 1952 case, Morissette, where they spanked the DOJ over this, saying in 1952, criminal intent is for every element of the offense. This guy didn't think he was breaking the law. He did everything right out in the public when he took those brass shell casings off of the dummy target range that the planes use and smashed them into scrap metal and sold them on the market. He didn't try to cover up his activities. He made full disclosure when they contacted him over it, and they charged him with threat of those shells off the bombing range that otherwise would have just wasted away in the elements. Here we go. Second paragraph. Ilonis's conviction, however, was premised solely on how his post would be understood by a reasonable person. Such a reasonable person standard is a familiar feature of civil liability and tort law, but is inconsistent with the conventional requirement for criminal conduct, awareness of some wrongdoing. Having liability turn on whether a reasonable person regards the communication as a threat. Can you hear how whether or not it's a threat was just handed off to somebody else has nothing to do with you? Has to do with how somebody else would interpret it. Well, what if the person's an idiot? What if they're out in the street throwing bottles at cop cars? Because it's what to do in a bunch of cities here in the U.S. He goes on, regardless of what the defendant thinks, reduces culpability on the all-important element of the crime to negligence. You can only punish them for negligence. They didn't have criminal intent. And we have long been reluctant to infer that a negligence standard was intended in criminal statutes. How about that? Citing Alonis. The next case. The manner in which the courts ordinarily interpret criminal statutes is fully consistent with this ordinary English usage. That is to say, courts ordinarily read a phrase in a criminal statute that introduces the elements of the crime with the word knowingly as applying that word to each element. For example, this court interpreted a federal food stamp statute that said, whoever knowingly uses, transfers, acquires, alters, or possesses coupons or authorizations cards in any manner not authorized by law is subject to imprisonment. The question was whether the word knowingly applied to the phrase in any manner not authorized by law. The court held that it did. Despite the legal cliché, ignorance of the law is no excuse. You have to know this stuff when somebody says you're guilty of something. It applies to all criminal statutes. I'm just looking at threat statutes tonight. Next case is Torres versus Lynch. Consider the law respecting mens rea, or criminal intent. In general, courts interpret criminal statutes to require that a defendant possess a mens rea, or guilty mind, as to each element of the offense. Supreme Court, 2016. That's recent enough for me. Here's Ninth Circuit, 1994. It is fundamental that a person is not criminally responsible unless criminal intent accompanies the wrongful act, citing Morissette, 1952. Consequently, to have probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed, an arresting officer would have to reasonably believe that Sharon Gasho intended to defy and frustrate the seizure of these ships when she removed the logbooks. All she was doing was securing the logbooks, and they charged her with a crime. She had no intent to frustrate or defy the seizure. So you should get dismissed on it when you prove that you have no criminal intent. They'll overlook it just because they know every judge is corrupt, and they'll suppress all the evidence necessary to convince the jury. And then the prosecution's allowed to go with all the other evidence and make all these inferences on the record and screw you in and your reputation in the eyes of the jury. Now, U.S. versus Cassell, 2005. Is the next case, bold in italics. The existence of a mens rea is the rule of, rather than the exception to, the principles of Anglo-American criminal jurisprudence. It's bigger than the Supreme Court. Thus, except in unusual circumstances, we construe a criminal statute to include a mens rea element even when none appears on the face of the statute. Having held that intent to threaten is a constitutionally necessary element of a statute punishing threats, we do not hesitate to construe this statute to require such intent. Okay? So, I have to have intent. It has to be a true threat. A true threat is defined as a first-person reference to first-person threat to commit an act of unlawful violence. Next paragraph under Cassell. With all you now know, taught to you directly by appellate and Supreme Court judges and justices, did your email to the felon violate 875C? Does this plea agreement below accuse you of a crime under 875C? Oh, you're indicted, jerked out of your house. They're going full on, and they've charged you with a threat. You don't believe it's a threat, but other than that, here's the plea agreement that they say, you got to sign this or we're going to bring 14 other false charges against you. We're going to bring a 922G3 charge against you. 18 USC 922G3. If the Fed goes into your house and they find that you're a pot smoker and you own a gun, it's a federal crime. If you have a joint and a gun, it's a federal crime. Well, he had 14 guns, Your Honor. That's 14 crimes, and we're going to go to the grand jury and get those 14 garbage charges against you if you don't plead guilty to this. Does this plea agreement accuse you of a crime? Quote, and this is just above conclusion, indented. Defendant admits that he threatened to cause others to enter the felon's home to arrest him by law for offenses defendant felt had been committed against him by police officers working for the city of Podunk. Sounds like the felon is a public officer, doesn't it? Like the police chief who knew it was false what they were doing? Whoever. Defendant further admits that he advised the felon not to resist. Oh, so there's no criminal intent to commit an act of unlawful violence, is there? As the people he was working with would be heavily armed and authorized to use force by law. End quote. Isn't that in fact exactly what you did? And isn't it in fact not a crime? Threaten to cause others to do it by law. And don't resist. There's no threat in that. Conclusion. A plea agreement is a contract and is enforced as such. See these three cases. Does the email message to the felon constitute a true threat? A citizen's arrest is legal, so there's no unlawful violence. Causing others to act is legal, even if unlawful violence is their plan. And you obviously lacked criminal intent. Not guilty. The U.S. Department of Justice wrote that plea agreement in an actual criminal case over the email message above. I'm not kidding you. Did you notice that the DOJ put arrest in quotation marks like it was a fiction when it's perfectly lawful? All judges and prosecutors operate under the presumption that everyone has criminal intent in whatever they do. With the knowledge that even this plain innocence didn't keep the DOJ from bringing a false charge under a statute that carries 60 months in prison, max, please use caution in your own speech and strictly scrutinize the use of the term threat by others, especially if they're talking about you. That defendant wasn't even close to violating that charging statute, but he went to prison for 40 months anyway. America and the DOJ call this a victory. Don't be the next victim of this corruption. Stay not guilty. How about that? I hand it right to you. There's a couple new people on the chat. Let me give you the page that I was talking about. There's a link to it on the link section. Scroll down, takefromcaesar.us, or this will take you right there. It's a page about what does and does not constitute a threat. I've taped this show, and I'm going to be posting it to the archive. Let me close the show real quick. Stay with me. My name is David Merlin. None of this is legal advice. It was my pleasure to bring this information to you. And you can't trust the government, so there's no such thing as legal advice. And with that being my last Monday show in the month of May, I'm glad to offer this series of recorded calls in my archive here at 59615. And be earnest in your scholarship and careful in your conduct. Thanks for everything, and I'll see you in the next lesson.